everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy brought to you every Friday night here on KCRW. Now, if I had my way, probably the two most successful newspaper columnists in the humor field would be Calvin Trillin and Roy Blunt Jr. But since I don't, I would imagine, not having any statistics to look at, but I would imagine that the two most successful columnists in the humor field are Irma Bombeck and Art Buchwald. Now, I ran across one record each by these two columnists, and I figured, well, you know, no matter how bad they are, these are, you know, world-class humorists, and I'll find something that I'll be able to play from them. And in listening to them, I found that the Irma Bombeck album was surprisingly weak. It had some moments, but wasn't terrific. And that the Art Buchwald album was surprisingly wonderful. I thought there's a lot of great stuff on this. So as a result, this program, which is devoted to the humor, in public at least, of Irma Bombeck and Art Buchwald, will be much more of Art Buchwald than it will be of Irma Bombeck. Not that I don't think Irma Bombeck is a funny writer, but it's just, you know, what's on the record and what isn't. Anyhow, Irma Bombeck's record was made in 1977. It is called The Family That Plays Together Gets on Each Other's Nerves, which I guess by telling you that I have spoiled one of the better punchlines that you'll hear. And Art Buchwald's album was made, I believe, in 66, and is called Sex and the College Boy. But we'll start off with Irma Bombeck and the few cute pieces I was able to find on this record, and here's one about two-year-olds.
Parents will be happy to know that I've done a lot of research about children. I am the one who organized a movement that would either raise the driving age of a child to age 35 or lower the age of menopause to 12. I just feel that those conditions should not pass one another in the night. Now, I would like to preface my remarks with just a small explanation here. First, I want to assure you I love children. I cannot imagine a life without children. But at the same time, I'm extremely realistic about them. And I regard them for exactly what they are. A punishment from God. Now, my mother lied to me. She did not tell me that God could not be everywhere at once, so he invented two-year-olds. My mother dropped by one day, and I was in a fetal position under the kitchen sink, talking on the phone. And my mother said to me, "Where's the baby?" I said, "Where the baby always is when I'm on the telephone. He's sitting up on the television set, stark naked, chewing on a raw potato." And she said, "Irma, have a little understanding. The baby is probably teething." She always said that. The baby's probably teething. She said, "You know, why don't you just try a little whiskey on the gums?" And I took a belt, and I felt better. I really did. My mother never told me that the high spot in my day, this is the biggie now, the pinnacle, the absolute peak, would be taking knots out of shoestrings with my teeth that the kid had wet on all day long. I don't understand parents sometimes. It's almost like they work at inflicting pain on themselves. We all do it. I know our family has a ritual, an exercise in futility that we go through, and we call it the family vacation. And I have always had a theory and that the family that plays together gets on each other's nerves. And yet every year we climb into the car and we go on a vacation that's just about as giddy as the Nuremberg trials. I don't know what it is with us. I know a lot of families, they have a swell time. They play games like Count the Cow. And their kids take 18-hour naps. And a lot of them even sing songs like Getting to Know You, you know, from the King Family album. And our family plays a game called Get Mama. And what this is, it's a 400-mile nonstop argument that begins when we leave the driveway and does not end until I threaten to self-destruct. Now, the players include my family. There are my two sons, Cain and Abel. And there is our daughter who has kidneys the size of lentils. Cain argues with Abel for 75 miles on whether or not you could run a car 100 miles in reverse without stalling. He argues for another 68 miles on whether or not you can use a yo-yo on the moon. He argues for another 110 miles on whether or not toads bleed through the eyes when they die. They threaten to slap 55 times, punch 33 times, and say, "I'm telling," 138 times. Now, do you have any idea what it is like to spend an entire vacation with a kid with a one-word vocabulary? Gross. The motel is gross, the food is gross, the girls are gross, the tours are gross. And I don't know why, but I have a feeling that if someone parted the Red Sea for him, he would take a pocket comb out of his pocket, whip it through his hair, and say, "That's gross." Now, the younger son, oh, he's a gem. I don't want to leave anyone out. After he has photographed everyone's teeth in the car, he recites all the new words that he just read on the last restroom wall, and he gets the dogs so worked up that he throws up in the picnic basket. The driver of the car, who started out as great, big, wonderful dad, has changed. His body is rigid. His shoulders are hunched. His eyes are glassy. And he has not made a pit stop in 8.5 hours. I say to him, "When are we going to stop and eat?" And he says, "Is that all you can think of is your stomach?" And I say, "No, I think a lot about dying." He said, "If you can just see a decent place to stop, just let me know. I'll do it." And I said, "How can I see anything when you're traveling 60 miles an hour? What was that blur we just passed?" He said, "Chicago." I said, "You know, you're really impossible to travel with." He said, "Why would you say a rotten thing like that?" I said, "I'm not the only one. I think there has to be something wrong where the hitchhiker writes us a check to let him out of the car." And finally, you see it up ahead, and I say, "Hey, look up ahead, kids. We lucked out. There's a pair of golden arches." My husband says, "That's St. Louis. I'm going to keep going." Then he says, who's kicking my seat? You know I cannot drive when someone is kicking my seat. Turn around and give him a rap. You give him a rap, he's a bleeder. Then, of course, there's patient, wonderful mother. And mothers, for some reason, are always in charge of reading road maps. They're old road maps. My husband said to me once, where are we now? I said, somewhere in the Southern Confederacy.
I covered the campaign, the recent campaign, the presidential campaign, and the one question that people are still asking was the press fair to Goldwater? And I'm one of the people who think that the press was not fair to Goldwater. For one thing, we quoted him. To Goldwater. And if you recall, during the missile crisis, Secretary McNamara said our missiles were good, and Goldwater said our missiles weren't any good. And nobody knew. So I wrote a column, and I said there was only one way to find out. And that was to put Barry Goldwater in a rowboat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and have McNamara fire one of the missiles. Now, if the missile missed Barry Goldwater, that meant it was no good. And McNamara would have to publicly apologize. On the Ed Sullivan Show. But if the missile hit Barry Goldwater, he'd have to withdraw his name from the presidential election. Now, as soon as the article appeared, the first person I heard from was McNamara, who said, I'll do it. But Goldwater said he'd like to think it over. I've been doing an awful lot of traveling around, and I've been lecturing in a lot of towns. And the one thing that I've discovered, particularly in the smaller towns, is they have four or five organizations to fight communists. But they don't have any communists. For example, I was in Sarasota, Florida, and the nearest card-holding communist was in Miami. And Miami wouldn't let him go. So they called Jacksonville. And Jacksonville said, we need all we've got. So I've called for a redistribution of the Communist Party. So each town would get one. And he'd be kind of the resident communist. And he'd be paid by the town to be the threat there. They'd throw garbage on his lawn, break his windows, beat up his kids. And I sent this idea to J. Edgar Hoover, and he never answered my letter. which made me write an article recently about the fact that I didn't think there was any J. Edgar Hoover. And I said in this article that he was actually made up by the Reader's Digest. Now, another thing that occurred to me, it probably hasn't hit you people yet, or what the toy people are doing to America, is what they're doing in regards to these dolls. Now, when I first came back, my daughter asked me for a Barbie doll. And it only cost $3, and one doll looks just like another as far as I'm concerned. So I thought nothing more of it until a week later when my daughter returned and said, Barbie needs an evening gown. And I said, so does your mother. She says, but there's one in the catalog for only $4. And I said, what catalog? And she said, the one that came with the doll. And I grabbed the catalog, and much to my horror, I discovered what the makers of Barbie were up to. They'll let you have the Barbie doll for $3, but you have to buy clothes for it $3 a crack. They have about 200 outfits from negligees to mink jackets in the catalog. And a girl's status in the neighborhood is based on how many Barbie outfits her doll has. In a month, I had managed to spend $200 clothing Barbie. Though I only spent $45 clothing my daughter. I thought I was squared away until one day my daughter came in and announced that Barbie was lonely. So I said, let her join a sorority. And she said, she wants Ken. And I said, who's Ken? And she showed me the catalog, and sure enough, there was a doll named Ken. The same size as Barbie, with crew-cut hair and a vinyl plastic chest. If you don't get Ken, my daughter warned, Barbie will become an old maid. So I went out and I bought Ken, and pretty soon I had put up $400 to protect my original $3 investment. A few weeks later, my daughter announced Barbie and Ken were getting married. The marriage clothes were in the catalog, and so was their dream house, which cost $29 each. Once the wedding was over, I thought everyone would live happily ever after. But I made a mistake. I bought my daughter another doll called Midge, who was supposed to be a friend of Barbie's. And one day my daughter came to me and she said, Barbie wants to get a divorce. I said, why? And she said, Ken has fallen in love with Midge. And I finally discovered what had happened. It seems once Barbie had gotten married, she became a housewife and spent all her time cleaning up the dream house and cooking meals for Ken. She either dressed in a house coat or an old dress, and she kind of let herself go. Midge, on the other hand, always showed up at the house dressed to the teeth. Since Midge had no dream house to clean, she could afford to spend all her time looking beautiful. I thought fast. If I allowed Ken and Barbie to get a divorce, I'd have to buy a whole new trousseau for Midge, which would cost me another $1,000. So I announced what Barbie and Ken needed was a marriage counselor. And I happened to be one on the side. And I went over to the dream house and had a serious talk with Barbie and Ken. Well, my daughter listened. And I told Barbie the reason she was losing Ken was because she had forgotten a housewife must always look pretty when a husband came home. And I told Ken the reason he was attracted to Midge was because she looked beautiful. Once she got married, she would look just like Barbie. And I told Ken he had a good deal and not to louse it up. And then I went over to Midge and warned her she could only visit Barbie and Ken once a week. And if she gave Barbie any more trouble, I was going to throw her away. Well, everything is going fine now, except Barbie's about to have a baby. And it's going to cost me another $135. In pursuit of stories, I've even offered myself as a Peace Corps volunteer to go down to the Riviera. Of course, the people down there are walking around half naked, lacking shelter, some without even a boat, and they need help. And I offered to live the way they did. And eat the food they did, and drink the native wine to show them I was one of them. But they turned me down. Sarge Shriver had already applied for the job. I've been proud of many things since I've been in Europe, but I think the thing that I've been the proudest of is what's now become known as the 6-minute Louvre. Now, as you know, there are only three things worth seeing in the Louvre Museum. That's the Winged Victory, the Venus de Milo, and the Mona Lisa. And the rest of the stuff is all junk. And for years, tourists have been trying to get through the Louvre as fast as possible to see those three things and then go out shopping again. And before the war, their record for going through the Louvre was 7 minutes and 15 seconds. But after the war, as clothes got lighter and cameras got lighter, people kept cutting down the time. And in 1948, a man known as the Swedish Cannonball paced by his Welsh wife, did it in 6 minutes and 20 seconds. And pretty soon, people started talking about a 6-minute Louvre. Well, a friend of mine named Peter Stone, who I'd gone to Russia with, came to me one day and he said, "I think I can do it." He says, "If you go in on Sunday morning, you don't have to pay. And I can cut 15 seconds from the time." Well, I had a lot of faith in Peter, because he was the first one who ever looked at the Winged Victory and said, "It'll never fly." So we called a starter from Thomas Cook, and we called a timer from American Express, and Peter showed up on a Sunday in his tracksuit. And he has to do this from a waiting taxi, because you always tell the taxi to wait when you go to the Louvre. And the gun went off, and Peter dashed in around the Venus de Milo, up past the Winged Victory, down to the Mona Lisa. And you always have to say something when you look at the Mona Lisa. And Peter says, "I know the guy who has the original." And dashed down into the waiting taxi, and Peter Stone broke the 6-minute Louvre and did it in 5 minutes and 19 seconds. And that record still stands if any of you are going to Paris and would like to break it. Now, if you read my column, you probably know I write quite a bit about my wife and my children. And they're supposed to supply me with 2 out of the 3 articles a week. And if they don't, they go. And one which my son supplied me with when he was 7 years old, and it shows you how fouled up we are in the world today, had to do when I took him to a movie in Paris. And it was a war movie about the Americans and the Japanese. And in the movie, the Japanese were very cruel to the American Marines. So when we came out of the movie, he said to me, "The Japanese were very bad people during the war, weren't they, Daddy?" I said, "Yes, but they're not bad people now." He said, "Why? Are they different people?" I said, "No, they're the same people." He said, "Then why did they do bad things?" I said, "Well, they probably thought they were doing good things." And he said, "Well, why didn't someone tell them they were doing bad things?" I said, "We tried to, but they wouldn't listen." He said, "Remember the war picture we saw some weeks ago about the Germans beating up the people in the concentration camps?" I said, "Yes." He said, "The Germans are bad people, aren't they?" I said, "No, they were bad people, but now they're good people." I said, "You see, once you start a war, you can't stay mad at the people after the war is over, because if you did, there'd be another war." He said, "But in the movies, they're still bad people." I said, "Yes, that's to remind us they were bad people, but we're supposed to forget it." And he looked at me blankly and he said, "How many Russians did you kill during the war?" And I said, "I didn't kill any Russians during the war. During the war, they were good people." And he said, "But if they were good people during the war, why are they bad people now?" And I said, "The Russians aren't bad people. Their leaders are bad people. And their leaders are trying to give us trouble all the time over Germany." And he said, "With the bad Germans?" I said, "No, with the good Germans. The bad Germans want to kick the good Germans out of Berlin." And he said, "Then there still are bad Germans." And I said, "Of course, you clot." And he said, "Why didn't the Russians kill the bad Germans?" I said, "They don't think their Germans are bad. They think our Germans are bad. And their Germans are good. And we think their Germans are bad. And our Germans are good." I said, "Now do you understand?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, it doesn't make any difference if you do or not. Everybody else does." Thank you.
And there you have it. That's going to do it for this week's show featuring Art Buchwald with an album recorded back in 1966 entitled Sex and the College Boy. That was on the Capitol label, a very rare record, though. I've never seen it. I obviously saw it once when I bought it, but I really don't see it that much. And Irma Bombeck's record, I guess, is also very rare. That was on the Warner Brothers label. Next week, we'll be listening to the work of Joan Rivers with some rare stuff. Back when she was single, I got a record on the back. It mentions that she's single, so if you want to date her, you can. And we'll take that up to her more recent stuff. Actually, it's not all that recent, because even her most recent album talks about how fat Elizabeth Taylor is. And things change. They certainly do. Let's see. I think that's about it. There is something coming up with Norman Cousins and John Cleese as part of AFI that you might want to look into. Call either AFI or UCLA. That's going to be on March 15th, I think 7-ish or 8-ish or something. I don't have as much information as I'd like to for you, but I've given you a start, and the rest is up to you. Anyway, until next week when we listen to Joan Rivers, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you, as always, to keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.